Everyone, welcome back to the Screenwriting Life. I'm Meg LaFauve. Lorian couldn't join us this week, but Jeff and I are thrilled to be welcoming best-selling author, speaker, and script consultant Dr. Linda Seeger onto the show.
Though officially retired and focusing on writing, during her time as a script consultant, Linda Seeger was one of Hollywood's most sought-after consultants, in part because she helped define and create the idea of script consulting as a career. She's consulted on over 2,000 scripts, including over 100 produced feature films and over 35 produced television projects, with past clients that include Peter Jackson and Ray Bradbury, among others.
Linda's books have become foundational texts in the study of and craft of screenwriting. Her best-selling book, Making a Good Script Great, is frequently endorsed by Ron Howard, who has used it to inform all of his movies, beginning with Apollo 13. And I'm a personal huge fan of her book, Creating Unforgettable Characters. It's one of the first books I read when I came to Hollywood, and it really, really was so insightful and helped me learn writing at such a wonderful, basic, and yet complex level. So I am personally thrilled to say hello, Linda.
Hello, nice to be here.
Wonderful. Now, we can't wait to chat with you, but Linda has agreed to go ahead and be part of our adventures in screenwriting, or AKA what we did this week. I will start off. Normally, we throw to Lorian. Boohoo, she's not here, so I'll start. I want to talk about something in terms of the craft that is a little bit hard for me to describe that I'm experiencing this week, but I'm going to try, which is so much of our art of writing is about layering. You know, for me, life in real life, people's experiences and our stories are very subtle. We experience things in a subtle way sometimes, and it starts to build up. Our behavior can be very subtle, and we communicate sometimes in incredibly subtle ways. And I really love digging into those subtleties. It's what I love to do as a writer. It's where I find a lot of the authenticity that I'm looking for and uniqueness to character and plot. But then when you're working within a genre, it can be very hard because the genre is going to have very clear needs to please the crowd and entertain the crowd. And I start to bang up against a little bit want it to be authentic. And yet I gotta, you know, you gotta have the bad guy vanquished at the end or whatever it is that genre is calling for. And I'm just working that tightrope of subtlety and authenticity. And is there another way to quote unquote vanquish a bad guy that feels more real and thematic to what emotionally I'm trying to layer into this screenplay? And then of course, each draft becomes more and more layering. You know, I can't tell you how many different versions of this story my husband, who's my writing partner, I have done. I mean, almost nothing that we started with is still in there. And that was my experience at Pixar. Almost nothing in the original boards ends up in the movie. And that can be hard because you're not experiencing the layering. You're experiencing the throw out, start again. Oh, my God. And it can feel very much like, oh, my God, I just wasted all this time. Why did I go down that road? It was such a waste of time, which can really freeze you up, right, going forward because you're like, I don't want to waste more time. I don't want to do another version and it's not right. But it's not about right and wrong and it's not about throw out. It really is like layering sediment. Each draft, each idea, each try, each attempt becomes this sediment that is depositing into your riverbed, and it's actually building land. I don't know if this is the best metaphor, but it is building land that you are going to stand on and everybody's going to stand on and say, this is the movie. And so few people really understand, even people who think they know movies, they really don't understand the amount of layering and time and iteration it takes to get something that feels so simple and the way great art feels simple and inevitable and of course. But boy, it's that layering that it takes to get there is really crazy. But once it clicks, once you do start to get your feet on that dry land, there's nothing more fun because all of that sediment can really hold you so firmly and it's working and suddenly you're like, oh my God, this is a movie. So I'm in the layering process right now, a little bit nervous about the tidal wave that's going to come behind me and possibly wash it all away. But I'm just going to keep going here. So Linda, how was your week?
My weeks are generally good because I'm living in the mountains of Colorado.
Oh,
And
nice.
as my husband says, there is no such thing as a bad day in Colorado mountains in the Rockies. So, and I'm writing my memoirs, which is my next book, which I think is my 20th.
Wow.
And when you count the editions, we're either 34 or 35, and I literally have to sit down at some point and list all my books and say, what is this? This is my 19th or 20th. And I am generally a very disciplined writer. I mean, I write when I'm writing a nonfiction book, for instance, I'm doing maybe 2 mornings a week. But I'm not doing that this time. So I'm kind of doing the undisciplined approaches, which is when I feel like it.
Oh, nice.
And I did write in my memoirs this probably a couple days ago, I wrote the chapter called P Famous People I've Met or Who I Was in the Presence of. And I love to break the rules when I feel they work. I mean, I generally, like I know exactly what I did there is I have a preposition at the end of the title. And then I always have feedback from a variety of people who represent my audience. So if you're a screenwriter, you'd say, who's gonna, is this a children's movie? Is this is it an adventure? What is it? And then I would get people that are like that to say, okay, is this working? So one of the, but I don't do that at the beginning. I don't do anything first draft. I do it later. And then, so I don't know whether that's a cute title or not, but I'm having fun
Because you haven't had your
with it.
feedback.
And it was amazing to me because I'm as someone who's worked in the film industry, but on the writing side, you're not around famous people a lot. That is, you think of famous people as actors. And I was surprised that there were some actors that I have spent time with. I mean, Leigh Vollman, Loretta Young. I was in the presence of Tom Selleck, but there is no way one can talk when you are in the presence. It's 6 or 8 feet away. And I thought, oh my gosh, is that guy gorgeous? So that has been really good. And we're changing our decorating from winter to spring now. And so we've had someone here today. It's a charming house I live in. So
Oh,
that was a
wonderful.
good week.
I love it. Jeff,
I
how was
love
your
it.
week?
It was good. I should tell you, Linda, I tried to grow a mustache last winter in honor of Tom Selleck just because he's such a beloved celebrity, and I just did not pull it off the same way he did. So I learned the hard way. You have to be a certain threshold of attractiveness to pull off a mustache. It's the
on.
Tom Selleck threshold. I'm not too far from there, but let's be honest. I don't
Oh,
disagree
come
with you.
on. I would say, yeah, I would say, Jeff, that you're attractive, if I dare say this.
Oh, that's very
You're not
nice.
Tom Selleck.
I'm not Tom Selleck. I know. That's why I'm a writer, though. I don't have any on-camera aspirations, and I'm a podcast host and a writer, so I have the perfect face for both. Meg, I'm so glad you talked about sort of this kind of striking a balance you're feeling between like following the rules and conventions of your genre and honoring like the truth and subtlety of your characters, because I'm dealing with the exact same thing right now. I have a couple features that I have like deadlines on that are sort of being read right now, which is great. And so I'm finally kind of in the vomit draft for this idea I've been talking about for like years that I love, but I've probably been afraid to write because I know deep down it doesn't really work. And I've been afraid to put it on paper. And so specifically, like I can feel myself engineering the story math that I need to like push through this vomit draft, but simultaneously feeling that like these aren't really ringing true. These moments don't really feel true. And the way this antagonist is pushing my protagonist into act two feels convenient. And it's almost hard to power through that dialogue when you know it's not truthful. It's funny, my first feature is like a very kind of small, sort of intimate coming of age dramedy that I love, but it doesn't necessarily have the same commercial appeal as
Yeah,
like a
big
more,
genre things, yeah.
yeah. So it's been interesting to try to like navigate what my instincts are telling me feels emotionally true versus like what I know some of these rules are to make something commercial. And
Well,
I'm
and as Linda just said, rules are made to be broken. And
right.
she just said she very specifically knows when she's breaking the rule. And that is true of genre too. Like
Yeah.
you can break them, but I hear you because especially those early drafts, part of your brain is like, you got to hit the genre points, hit the genre points. And let's face it, a lot of the executives and producers are going to be reading for the genre points, but they're also going to be reading for emotion and why they care. And oh my God, this is just genre. We can't make this. What? Why do I care about these people? What's authentic? So I have even found myself doing drafts of like, this is the big bad genre draft, just so
Yeah.
I can play with set pieces and what's fun and but pretty much I always end up back with the authentic draft and letting the genre go, which this is the draft we're on now, which is okay, we're just not going to worry about you have to have a scare by such and such page or whatever it is. We're just trying to enjoy the characters, enjoy the story, and let it go where it wants to go. And it's been fun, which is, you know, always the best part when it actually turns into fun and not torture. And we like them. It's fun to like your characters when you find them. And it's taken a while to find them, quite
Yeah.
honestly, because the first iteration of them, I don't think felt authentic. But this one does. So it's just layering, Jeff. You're just gonna have to do it
I
over and
know.
over and
I
over
know.
again.
I'll find it, but it was just very heartening, Meg, to hear you share that because I was like, okay, I'm not alone. Like, even the
No.
greats and like
Oh, thank you.
bump.
But
It's just
yes.
you can feel yourself bumping, is how it feels. So
And
thank
you know,
you.
I watched at Pixar as people who had won multiple characters of war awards did not bump. They slammed into brick wall,
It's great.
slammed hard
Yes.
into a brick wall. And it's just part of the layering process. And they understand it at Pixar because they're artists, so they've drawn so much in sketchbooks. They understand it's just kind of a quick iteration.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's go on to Linda because she's here and I'm so excited. Here's my question, because of course your most famous book and what everybody knows is What Makes a Great Script.
Making a good script great.
Making a good
Sorry.
script great. So if you had to pick one thing that makes a good script great, one, what would it be?
Well, a lot of professional writers say structure, structure, structure. And it isn't as if it's like building a home. And you say, if you don't have the frame and the framework, then the ceiling's going to fall down. And but the difficulty is that screenwriting, like any art form, it's an art and a craft. And some people easily they get in the craft. And when I say structure, they say, oh yeah, then I have to follow rules. You say, no, structure is sort of the building block. It's the technique. And some people don't take technique seriously. But if you have just technique without art, then you can follow it. It's clear, it's clean, but it's certainly not different and wonderful. And if you just have art, meaning your expression and your something new and unique that you are doing, it falls apart because people get lost along the way. So you're always balancing these. And I often say with writers, one of those at a certain point will come to the forefront. And whichever comes the forefront, just pursue it. I mean, eventually they have to both be together, but you don't just do one or the other. And I think as you become more skilled, then what you begin, your skill advances and you're putting them together. And you have that moment where you say, this works. I got the two integrated together.
I'm still waiting for that. But yes, no, it does happen eventually after many
Eventually.
drafts. So it's interesting because I don't know if I learned this from your book about characters, unforgettable characters, because I read it in a time when I was mulching so many things. I was mulching your book. I was mulching learning from my boss at the time, who was an actress. I was learning from reading scripts. I was learning about myself, right? You're forming yourself as an artist, as a writer, right? Which is also layering, which is what I think is so beautiful. What you're talking about is that you have to layer yourself. You have to learn craft. You have to learn your voice. You have to learn art. It just takes time. But do you think the way I approach that sweet spot between character, sorry, between a structure and art, which art, I might use the word authenticity, but I think both are absolutely true. I try to look at structure as the movement of the emotional thematic as experienced by the character. So I think of structure as where is the character right now at the end of Act One? Where is the character and their relationships at the midpoint? And that helps my brain keep a hold of that art or that authenticity over just structure and just kind of external things. How do you approach character and structure and where it meets?
Well, the first thing, and I expect most of your listeners know this, that I'm not a script writer. I'm was a
I know.
script consultant, and people get confused about that because I have a lot of people who say, "How in the world can you be one without the other?" One of the jokes in my life is that someone was talking to Warren Beatty about me because he was having trouble with the script, and they said, "Well, maybe you should hire Linda Sager." And he says, "What good is she? She's never written an Academy Award-winning script." I said, "Well, there's these two parts of the process. There's the creative and the analytical. And in as a screenwriter, you are going to lean more toward the creative side. As a script consultant, I lean more toward the analytical side, but my work was very creative. I mean, I retired a couple of years ago, so I was 39 years as a script consultant. And again, you're finding the balance. So I didn't.
But let's say you had somebody come to you with the script and they were really relying, their characters were a little flat and they were relying too much on structure, or you weren't seeing that artistic, that art coming through you through character. What kind of advice would you give them?
Well, one of the things people began to understand about what I did is that I could take a script that was not very good, meaning, flat, derivative, etc., and I could craft it so well. I had an executive say to me one time, she said, "We got this couple scripts in, and the art, the craft was so high, so professional, and the art was not, and we could not figure it out because people generally have those two that kind of get elevated around the same time." And they said, "We found out they had all gone to you." I said, "I can take whatever you give me, and I could make it beautifully, professionally crafted, clear, clean, soaring momentum. I could do all of that, but I can free the artist within somebody, but I can't make it more than the best part of it." So if I always looked for what was the best part of that script and how can I raise the whole script to that level, and if the best part was just sort of average, I could help them create a very excellent average script. And if they were artistic, because I have a lot of work I've done in the creative process, I understand how a lot about how creativity works. And so I could pull that out of them and help raise everything, to level. So it's a balancing, it's
It's a
about.
really good point because, and I think people need to understand that when they go to a consultant or even their friends who are writers, whoever it is that you're handing your script to, they can give you feedback that is professional on how to craft something, but nobody can make you an artist. Nobody can hand you lava that's unique and specific to you. And that is such personal work to do. I think that consultants or friends or whoever can shine lights, places for you to go splunking, perhaps. But you've got to be the splunker. So I think that's a really, really good point.
And
Yeah.
and you have to know, you have to know where it soars. Even because I write nonfiction books, so I'm on my, I think it's the 20th book I'm on, is either the 19th or 20th. I'm doing my memoirs. But one of the things when I get feedback from people, I say, start with what constructive. I don't know what doesn't, I don't want you to tell me what doesn't work. I want you to tell me where does it soar. And in my character book, which you've mentioned, Creating Unforgettable Characters, I was writing a chapter and it was dreadful. It was just the worst. I said, this is the worst chapter that has ever been written in any book. And so I was 15 pages long. So I sat down and I said, where is it good? Where do I feel I'm working well? I found three sentences. I said, well, it's not
Awesome.
three. There were three sentences that were good. And I said, well, it's a start. So, and I had sent it off to somebody for feedback, and she knew how awful it was. And although she was very kind and all that, you want people to be kind and diplomatic, but not dishonest. But anyway, I rewrote it, and she said, I was reading your rewrite and I was waiting for my plane to leave and I almost missed my plane. She said I couldn't put the chapter down and I can't believe how much better it was. Well, I said, one of the things I've learned in the creative process is that you are in process. And so the first draft is not where you're going to end up. You're on the journey and don't get frustrated, don't get worried. So when people, one time somebody said, do you ever get writer's block? And I said, no, I don't, because I'm just in process. I know that to make a chapter really good in a book I'm writing, it's going to take 10 drafts. And I figure, you know, to make a script really good, you're going to go down that road and it's not going to happen on the first or second, so don't worry about it. Just say, this is how it goes. This is the creative process, and
It's funny because I've said that on the show, and yet when I'm doing it, I forget.
Yes, yeah.
It's
You have to have a big
so much
smile
harder to do
and say,
it
I'm
for
in
yourself.
process.
I love the idea of looking where does it soar, and I'm going to write that on a card and put it here at my desk because I do think that that's the way to go looking and splunking is where does it soar, and don't worry about the rest of it. Just look where it's working. In your book, you also talk about theme and that it's best discussed in images instead of dialogue. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, every movie should, every writing, but let's just say movies, you know, and fictions, there should be an idea behind it, and it should be fairly universal and something people can relate to. So, for instance, one of my favorite movies, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. You said, what's it really about? I would say liberation versus oppression. And it says in that the theme should have movement, meaning you are going to move from oppression to liberation in that movie. And so it's a movement. It's not just a statement. It's not somebody just saying, oh, you know, well, gee, you're oppressed. We have to liberate you. Is that you're actually going to see it through action and it's underlying. And you can test every scene to say, does this move my theme along during the scene? And can I actually see it through action, through what people do, and through images? So if I were doing, let's say you were doing liberation versus oppression, and you were doing a Western genre, you might say, how do I show oppression? Well, I might have a lot of fences, and they might be. You know, you're going to start thinking, what are the images of oppression? Is fences being limited, lower ceilings, for instance? You have stuff going on in a house, and you say, I know usually ceilings, let's just say they're 8 feet. I'm going to make them 7.5 feet. I'm going to pull this down and get this feeling that there's pressure that is keeping someone from being expressive. And you know, when you first start thinking of what those images are that show oppression or that show liberation, you're probably going to go to the usual, the conventional, you know, like fences. I just said fences. Now, if I were writing that, I might not stick with fences. I might say, maybe let me see if I can be fresher. Let me go for a walk around the block. How many images of liberation oppression do I see because I took a walk? Or, you know, what is it?
Right.
Many years ago, I was the keynote speaker at Romance Writers of America conference. And one of the things I did was I showed film clips, and I also read some romance novels and was talking about images. They had clotheslines. And I mean, they didn't really know they were doing oppression versus liberation. But I happened to talk about this, you know, I think I read, said, send me five romance novels. And it happened that in talking and choosing that one, because I thought she had such good images of that sense. It turns out the woman was in the audience. I must have, you know, my angel of doing the right thing and talking about the right thing must have been on my right shoulder on that.
That's awesome. And I love what I love about finding a versus is that it creates already dynamicness. It already creates conflict. It already creates, like you said, movement, so that the theme isn't just one word, but it already has within it a dynamic sense and conflict. And you're starting to get tension already. You also talk a lot in your book about subplots. You say that the plot is what the film is about, but a subplot shows what the film is really about. Is this also thematic, or is that something different when you talk about subplots?
Yeah, I think it is thematic. And I think you look many times at those. Now, it might be the love story. So, I mean, let's say that you're writing a mystery, but there's a love story. Is probably the love story is going to carry a lot about what that theme is. And so you're going to look at those characters and how they relate to each other. You know, is he controlling? Is she controlling? How do they limit each other? You know, so you look at those relationships. And a lot of times subplots tend to be more relational, where the driving force, or what I call the A story or that main story, is more action and event oriented. So people do things on there. They try to solve the mystery or find the lost child or whatever it is. But on those relational plots, which might not just be romance, they might be family oriented. They might be teacher student, whatever they are. You say, where can I get that grit going, right, you know, with this?
Now, in Act Two, you describe a successful Act Two. The word you often use is momentum.
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit? And,
yeah,
and problems, what did you see? How do you see writers misdiagnosing momentum problems?
Momentum is forward movement, and it's not the same as pacing. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, if you're doing an action adventure, it's probably going to move quickly. It's one action leads to another, leads to another. So I talk about momentum is like, let's say the guy in a romance, the guy says, you want to go out to dinner. The first thing on a date, the first thing is the answer is always yes. I mean, think about it. If he says no, you don't have a story, and that's the end. And I think that's true in life. You know, when people say, I could give you a free trip to Paris, would you like to go? The answer is not no. You don't get a story if you say, no, I don't want to go to Paris. I want to stay home and watch television. Say, well, you have just failed the test, and I am not casting you as my main character. So one thing I think about momentum is it's, one scene leads to another, leads to another. So if you say, I want to go out to dinner, you go out to dinner. So that's the action reaction. And then he says, I'm really interested in you, and I'm going on a little fishing trip this weekend. You want to come along? Yeah, cut to the fishing trip. Now, obviously, you're going to do it much more creatively, but you say scenes are not just episodes. They really are taking you someplace, which, of course, eventually is taking you to the climax of the story. But you want to keep connecting. It's almost like what you are doing, it's not just integrating, it's connecting one thing with another, with another, with another. And whether you go fast-paced or whether you go slow-paced in the fishing trip, is it takes a little while to catch the fish. But while you're ready to catch the fish, there's other things happening in the relationship. Like you decide the fish don't really matter.
What are some ways that you see writers doing momentum incorrectly or finding solutions that don't really work?
They do a scene because that reminds them of something that happened to them that they thought was interesting. He said, but it's not taking us anyplace. That whether it's a big journey or a little journey and a slow or a fast, it is a journey and it is going to move you, you know, forward. So, it's writing a scene for the sake of the scene and not seeing the whole.
Not seeing the whole and how it's escalating. And I also find that a lot of, especially emerging writers, but not always emerging, I've done it myself. The actions are all being taken by the other character, not your main character. And they're saying yes to Paris, and then they're saying yes to the fishing trip, but they're not actually creating the plot. They're just moving along with the creator of the plot. So often I have to go back and say, okay, if this was all up to her, how does she need him to go on a fishing trip? How does she get him to, go to Paris? So that's also the other quick thing that you can find in the momentum is who's actually creating the momentum. Not that you can't have a character, especially in the beginning, who is getting wrapped into something, but and I find actors want that too. They want to be the ones creating that momentum by their choices. Specifically about scene work, you talk about build an image in scenes.
Yeah.
Yes. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
I think of a scene is that a scene moves the story forward, a scene builds character, and a scene helps expand the theme, and it builds an image. So let's go back to this rather silly image I used, fences. And so you say, okay, where am I going to do with fences? Well, what do you do with fences? How do I work with fences? I used to have horses, and so I've been around ranches and all that. And I said, well, when you build a fence, you know, you got a pound. You got to dig the hole, and then you got to pound the post into it, and then you have to connect the fence. And so it's not just one thing you're doing. You're saying, I'm going to connect the fence. I'm going to make a gate. I'm going to do all this. And in order to plummet the depths of my theme, I might have to do a lot of brainstorming. You know, if you're going to take that is to say, well, what are all the different images I can think of limits? What are all the images I can think of expansion and expression and liberation and freedom and all that? And I think brainstorming is a lot of that. So sometimes people, you know, you start in the first five things you think of. For brainstorming is the stuff everybody else thinks of. And then what you start do is you brainstorm some more and you say, okay, 30 more things, because somewhere around there, it's going to start being fresh. And I often tell people, if you're brainstorming, don't evaluate. Just think, right. And then I suggest people circle what is good. Don't get involved with what's not working. Just circle the good things and say, what do you know? I got six images here I've never thought of before of what works with that. And remembering too, screenwriting is a visual, it's about visuals. And so people who are screenwriters need to learn to become visual thinkers. And you actually can train yourself to become a visual thinker. When I was working on my, I have a doctorate of all things in religion and the art and drama and theology. But part of my work in the 5 years it took me to get that degree was to really think about the creative process and think about visual thinking. And I read books and I would do sometimes exercises, sometimes every morning, is thinking of visual images that relate to themes, for instance, and ideas. And so there is a learning process to this, and you get better and better at it as you keep going because you become more confident and more knowledgeable about your, you know, your thinking.
Yeah, it's like working a muscle. I want to talk about character. You talk about there's three elements to a great character: risk, conflict, and transformation. Can you just briefly let us know kind of why you think those are the three elements of a great character?
Well, the first thing is that conflict is the guts. It's the blood. It's the, you know, it's kind of the core of a drama. And some people are very afraid of conflict. So their characters, everyone gets along and they all love each other. And you say, no, that's not drama. And you can be a nice person and still write screenplays. So, you can be nice. And sometimes I tell people, if you have trouble with conflict, go out during a day and ask yourself, but what were all the moments of potential conflict that you deflected rather than go into it? So if you go to the cleaners and you notice there's still just that little stain on the sleeve that probably they couldn't get out, they probably tried, and you said, it's okay, I roll up my sleeves anyway. So you say, well, okay, that was deflecting. So let's say you went into it. You said, oh my God, how many times have I come to this cleaners? Why in the world do I still have a stain? I mean, what kind of people are you? And they come back and you escalate. And so you can, what you do is you train yourself to learn to not only have a conflict, but to escalate it and make it worse and worse and worse in your mind. You still say, I'm a mature adult character who tries not to create conflict, but I am still going to, I still have to learn how to work with it.
So yeah, what it is,
one thing is conflict. So, and I don't think I talk too much about risk. I think that was somebody else's wonderful book. So whatever that was, everybody go and get that book too. But transformation, yes, and I have a, and you want the character to move and change. Now, not every character is going to change, but transformation is really a good, the transformational arc, that's a really good way of doing movement and letting your character grow and forcing things upon your character that will force them to make some kind of a change and have to react, and maybe react in a way that they usually do not react. So, and so now I do also talk about with character, I say a character thinks, acts, and feels. So they have an intellectual side, or, how they philosophize. You don't want a philosophizing character, but you might say the character still has to think and have a philosophy of life, of in some way that will come back and move through action, not just talking about it. And a character has, they act, they do things, they do events. A character who sits around and does nothing is not a character you want in your movie, so fire them and get somebody else who's better. But also characters feel. And I have worked on many a script where I said there's not 1 ounce of feeling. Now, when I worked with writers, I didn't say it that way. I was very constructive. But I might, you know, say to them, what is the character feeling in this scene? And I would often break down, you know, feelings as, well, my cousin, who was not a screenwriter, but she said once her psychologist told her, you mad, sad, glad, scared. She said scared. She meant scared, you know, scared. And I think sometimes fear and insults, offense, I mean, there's a lot of dimensions. And you can then start thinking about emotions in terms of what are the nuances? I mean, if I'm mad, am I just a little irritated? Am I pissed off, or am I inflamed and enraged? You know, there's all these dimensions within those. And we look at ourselves to say, when have I felt that way? And we look at other people. And you want characters who feel. So I have a friend who's very intelligent and certainly leans intellectual. And my friend Kathleen, sometimes I say, how are you? And she says, well, I don't really know. And one time she said, I feel a little sad. And I thought, this is not how Kathleen usually talks. She usually does not talk emotionally. And I said, well, when did you start feeling then? She said, I actually think about 3 years ago.
Oh, my goodness, I love this character already.
I know, but I didn't notice it until yesterday. And I have another friend, Lynn, her words are emotionally laden. If you say, how is she? Said, I am devastated. And I said, why? And she said, I thought he was going to call at 3 o'clock and he didn't call till 4 o'clock. So, and I mean, it is, you know, devastated. I'm intimidated. I'm scared. I mean, just emotionally laden. So characters have this big range of where they fit within that emotional layering. And I love your word layering. And so that's one of the things you want to do is you keep nuancing. What is that? And then you say, if my character is not an emotional character, what pushes them? What actually will create that emotion? And say, death in the family might do it. And, you know, being
killed. And I love when something, a character who's trying really hard not to be emotional, it's usually a very small thing that will finally be the thing. Something very small and specific, and it's like just one too many things to allow them to pop, right? Yes, I find, because that's how but what I love is that you're intuitively guiding people towards observing themselves and people in their lives to draw the authenticity of how human beings behave and how they handle their emotions, how they process emotions, how they express emotions. And that specificity of character, when it really comes from your life, it does have such a depth to it.
And I want to, if I could quickly say back to, just to summarize, because I think you said this so beautifully, Linda, in the book you talk about it as your characters having an intellectual life, an active life, and an emotional life, which is what we've been talking about. And the reason I love that so much is because it gives us as the writer context to actually be holding our characters accountable to having a full life. And it's like, we can take those three things and run them through our script scene by scene to see if we're really honoring the fullness, the depth of our character by clocking. What are they thinking philosophically? How are they acting behaviorally? And what are they feeling emotionally? And if we can try to fine tune those three things in every scene, we're going to create a deep character. So
we have to add, because it's something that I find so many people don't do. What do they want in the scene? Mm-hmm. Wanting something activates character. And people think I mean, oh, I want my mother to love me. No, that's not what I'm talking about. What do you want in the plot right now in this scene? Do you want to get out of the room? Do you want to get the information? Do you want, because people are just letting their characters float through scenes with a plot. It drives me bonkers, and I do too, by the way.
And I'm going to add one thing to this want, because people talk about want, And sometimes I say, what do you yearn for? What is it that in your, I mean, the core of your being? And I'll just give you an example. One time I was giving a seminar in, I think it was Santa Fe. And I said, you know, you think about what you yearn for. And I said, I'll tell you one thing I yearn for, because I was into horses at that time. I said, I yearn to be in a rodeo parade. And one of the women in the class said, I know the president of the Santa Fe Rodeo and I can make it happen.
Oh, my God.
Now, again, I didn't say no. I said yes, because you don't get a plot and you don't get a story if you say no. And so I rode two nights in the Santa Fe parade. I had the cutest outfit. I had red fringe gloves and my red boots. And when the president called me to just sort of tell me, you know, where we're going to meet, what the deal was. And I said, do you have a black horse? Because it will go with my outfit.
Yeah, and I love this character. Yeah.
I know. And there was a very gentle pause. He says, I think we can make that happen for you. So one night I rode a black horse and one night I rode a black and white paint horse. And it was one of the peak experiences of my life. I had so much fun waving to the crowd. So it's that deep sense. And that when you do it, you know, it was a really good thing because you're so satisfied and so joyful and happy.
Oh, I love it. It's like writing at the end of a script.
Yes.
Which I yearn for. All right. I know we have to let you go, but I want to jump in and make sure I get to one more question. Often emerging writers will talk to Lauren and I, and they'll say, how do I write good dialogue? And I personally am always stumped by this. Lauren, not so much, but I don't know how to teach how to write good dialogue. I don't, other than listen to the way people talk. But honestly, dialogue isn't always the way people talk. What's your point of view when you're working with somebody who really needs to learn the craft of dialogue?
Well, the first thing is I have a whole book on dialogue. It's called You Talking to Me? Writing Great Dialogue. I co-wrote it with a wonderful writer named John Winston Rainey, who is a script consultant and who is not retired. So you look up John Rainey and hire him if you need to. And you sort of, for one thing, is you tune yourself into how people speak and then write it down. So like, for instance, let's say you're riding in a taxi cab and the person in the cab, there's a person in the cab with you who's a heart surgeon. And you notice that they use certain scientific words. Well, you always have a notebook and a tape recorder with you. And one of the things that can be helpful is to say to someone, I'm writing a character just like, very similar to you, that I expect to be played by Brad Pitt. You know, find an attractive actor, male or female, you know, is find the right person that you think is going to be great for that. And to say, may I tape record you? We don't have to even talk about anything personal, just to get the rhythm and the feel of your speech. One of my clients, who's also a good friend, is the first woman to ever win an Emmy Award for sitcom writing. Treva Silverman wrote for the Mary Tyler Moore Show. Mm-hmm. And when I would work with her, she would, if I interrupted when she was getting the dialogue going, boy, does she shush me fast. And I learned we worked on three scripts together. And because she said when she's starting to get the rhythm, she tape records it. And she said, I might not say it that way, but I've gotten into the rhythm. And you want to listen to people's rhythm. Find those people that say something better and more interesting than fine. I'm fine. You want to say, right. What is it? What did they say? Maybe they said, this is one crappy day. This has got to be the crappiest day. I feel like I'm in hell. And, you know, I mean, how do they say things that are interesting and exciting and different and unique? And I have a friend who keeps file folders. And so I'll just give you, she gave me permission for this once. Her name's Jaren Cobb and she lives in Florida. And she had this line, in the South, we don't call it hot, we call it sultry. Isn't that a great line? And I said, Sharon, where did you get that? And she said, I heard something similar to that once. I wrote it down and I have a whole folder of Southern dialogue. So when I was asked to write a Southern script, what did I do? I opened up my folder and I found I had some really great dialogue and feelings. She said, I don't, you know, end up with it the same way, but it gave me a feel for that Southern dialogue. So you really are learning your ear. You're learning to hear better. And that, again, in a lot of stuff we do, we devalue learning. Don't devalue learning. Is that learning is tuning in, observing, noticing, listening, and all that. And pretty soon you start saying, yeah, I've heard some really cool dialogue over the years. And I'm getting better at hearing when somebody is doing something or saying something that's unusual. And you're thinking of dialogue as rhythm. You're thinking of word choice and vocabulary and what's fresh. So it is. It's a learning experience and a listening experience.
Yes, and I find too, if you read professional scripts, you start to see it like music on the page. It really is to see it on the page and how it moves through the page is very helpful too. This has been so fun. We always end every episode asking every guest the same three questions.
Okay.
So I'm going to ask you those now. Linda, what brings you the most joy when it came to being a script consultant?
I think it was seeing the fire light up in a writer that I would say something and because I wanted the light to shine on their script. And so it wasn't a matter of them, well, you know, now we learned and figured out some things to do. It was like, now I know what to do. And when I started my business, I took my doctoral dissertation. Really was the basis for my script consulting business, which sounds strange because that sounds so intellectual, but it wasn't. I was a theater director and I was directing a play called The Visit. That was my doctoral dissertation project. So rather, I still wrote a lot about it, but I directed it because in theater, you want to do something that really in theater, dramatic. And when I was working on the script, I thought, why is this such a great script? And I started looking, I took everything I knew about drama, you know, the conflict, the character transformations, all that. I started analyzing it and I developed a method of sort of understanding what are the elements that need to be in there and what element is missing. And so I flipped this, not on why this is a good script, is I flipped it to, you know, looking at scripts that were not great yet. And what are the elements that need to be coming in there that are not there?
Okay. What, when you were a script consultant, pissed you off about being a script consultant?
Do you know, I honestly don't think anything did. The only thing I'll give you but first of all is to just say I adored my job, and I know script consultants that get really pissed off over bad scripts, and I said, but that's our job.
That is the job.
Everything we work on doesn't work. That's the whole point. And if you don't want to work with things that don't work, you shouldn't be a script consultant.
Exactly.
But I'll tell you what did is dishonesty, inauthenticity. Ah. And I think in all those 2000 scripts, there was one script I sent back and I gave her back her money. It was It was, when I say bad, it was morally bad at its absolute core. And she hired two of us to work on as a team. Another Scope consultant is Dara Marks. And Dara and I were working on it, and we called each other and we discussed morally and ethically what we should do. I said, I'm going to give her money back and say, I do not want to read another page of this. I think I read 20 pages. And Dara said, I am going to give her the Riot Act. I'm going to do the work, but I'm gonna really rip it and just let her know this is just reprehensible. So that was one thing. Derivative scripts. In fact, I worked on a script and I said, this is ordinary people. You, I said, because I also sometimes did legal cases of copyright infringement, and I always wanted to see 75 things that were clearly infringed upon. I said, I could find 150 things in the script. I said, you cannot do this. I mean, I was really strong. And this guy was very, it was pretty angry at me. And I said, no, you cannot do this. You have just ripped off the script and there's nothing fresh about it. And
Yeah,
I'm,
no, that's a great answer, and it's a relative answer, of course. And that's where we go back to artistry, right? And then there's one last question we're going to have Jeff ask.
The last question we ask Linda is if you could go back and have a coffee with your younger self to give that Linda some advice, what would you tell her?
I would tell her you got it in you, and you just go for it, gal. And I think it starting a business, writing a script, all of this stuff is hard and difficult, and you got to have a lot of guts. And when they say you have what it takes or you don't have what it takes, and sometimes you don't know if you have what it takes. I would have told my younger self, you have what it takes. And don't be afraid to go down the path. Don't be afraid to learn, and you just go for it.
I love that. Thank, well, I'm so glad you said yes to us and came on our show. We have loved having you. Thank you so much for being here.
I'm happy to be here. This was great fun.
Thank you so much, Linda.
Thanks so much to Linda for joining the show today. Linda has 10 books that all discuss the craft of screenwriting, everything from subtext to dialogue to character, all available on her website.
And remember, you are not alone, and
And
keep
keep writing.
writing.